welcome to episode 63 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Schreffner. This week on the show, I'm joined by Leanne Hansen, an educator out of Australia, or as she describes herself, a thinker who occasionally teaches. She has taught English, film and media, and now teaches career skills to primary grade students. She is also the co-host of the EduNauts podcast, a member of the Voice Ed Radio Network, which focuses on the future WE standards, so I knew she'd have some good stuff to add to the show. Leanne and I talk about her unique position, the need for future-forward thinking, the lack of critical thinking among people in general, healthy skepticism and recognizing biases, the importance of communicating with educators outside your school and geographical space, and how great teachers are sometimes bad teachers. We have some technical issues during this episode, mostly as a result of Leanne Hansen's internet, but I think it is still worth the listen. So, sit back and enjoy episode 63 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Leanne Hansen. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler, and I am very excited today to get to sit down with someone who I have known on Twitter for over a year now. We've been on a couple different Voice Ed Radio podcasts together, and she is quite literally one of the most forward thinkers I know, if only for the fact that she's 14 hours ahead of me, and it's literally tonight for her as I record this morning. And that is Leanne Hansen out of Australia. How are you doing, Leanne?
I'm a little bit confused now also, Brad, but I'm otherwise doing quite well. Thank you.
Right as we were about to hit record, you made a comment about, oh, I hope our internet lasts, and then almost immediately your internet died out. So we had a rocky start as for our on-ramp, as Chris and Roland would say.
I'm just celebrating my enormous power over telecommunications.
Yeah, it's impressive that you can just think something and you manifest it into the world.
Yeah, that's basically how I teach as well.
Sounds about right. So for my audience who don't know you, could you give them a little intro to who you are and what you're about?
Okay. Well, at the moment, I would probably call myself a thinker who occasionally teaches. That's mostly because I'm not in a classroom at the moment. Right now, I actually work teaching career education to primary school students, which is quite a new idea and quite an interesting challenge. But in the past, I'm a film and media and English teacher, so I've taught a fairly diverse lot of students, and I spent quite a lot of time teaching just disengaged youth and a combined class with the disengaged youth and also long-term unemployed adults, so anyone from sort of 15 up to 65. So I've pretty much done it all, I'd say.
Yeah, and I love – can you tell me a little more about this teaching career to primary students? Because at least in the U.S., when we think of primary students, we're talking like up until about the age of 9 or 10. So what does that look like for you?
Okay, so we would start that early. At the moment, we're looking at sort of 11 and 12-year-olds. But the idea is not to teach them, like not to do career guidance counseling and, you know, put them in a box and say, yes, okay, you ticked off all of these things, so you get to be a doctor this week or something like that. It's about embedding all of the career skills that kids are going to need. Let's face it, they're facing a future that we're having a lot of trouble imagining ourselves. And none of us can predict it, obviously. So what we're trying to do is make sure that from an early age, these kids have the skills that they're actually going to need to navigate that future and to make decisions for themselves and not be kind of left behind.
And so what are some of the skills you focus on then at that age?
Okay, so we work a lot around design thinking. So we're looking at, obviously, design thinking starts with empathy. And so that's a really big one for what we're doing, is trying to develop lessons that kids can use that empathy and develop communication skills, appreciating diverse perspectives, that kind of thing. Along with that, of course, we need collaboration. You need to be able to work with people you really don't like, because we all have to do that from time to time. I obviously don't. I really love the people I work with. And I'm sure you do too, right, Brad?
100%. Every one of them.
Yeah. But our problem-solving skills are really important, obviously, and the ability to experiment and to, you know, be okay with failure and just to pick yourself up and reiterate and get on with things. So those are the kinds of skills that are going to be transferable across every job. It really doesn't matter what you do. You're going to need those kind of things. And then specifically looking at ways that they can actually experiment within the area of interest. So they might, you know, we talk a lot about them identifying themselves as being unique human beings and what the things are that make them up as unique. And then they also have obviously unique interests in the world of work and lots of different influences. So we get them to critically examine the influences to see whether they're, you know, whether they're coming from somewhere that actually resonates with them or whether they're feeling a bit of pressure from parents or friends or TV or anything like that. So yeah, it's really all about just making sure that if you're going to learn skills, they're going to be skills that are going to be beneficial for you and actually make you happy in the future, so that you can start to envisage it as something really positive and optimistic rather than this kind of doom and gloom and the robots are coming to take our jobs and computers are taking over the world. Because, I mean, really, if it wasn't for computers, my job would be boring.
Huh. That's a interesting perspective to take. Yeah, I like it, though. It's a positive perspective to take instead of looking at the doom and gloom. But there is the huge benefit of technology that is... The automation component is almost a consequence of all the benefits we take. I like that. It's a very nice way to look at it.
Yeah, well, my computer's really nice to me most of the time, and I get to play on social media and meet really interesting people and, you know, learn different things. And these are things that, I mean, we wouldn't be able to have this conversation without technology. And I wouldn't be able to do my job at the moment without technology, because the people I work with are actually based not just all over Australia but all over the world. So, you know, it's exciting, and obviously there's downsides. We're not completely unrealistic about it, but you don't want to focus on the downsides to the detriment of all the positives that there are.
Yeah, I agree. I think I completely agree. In fact, I was having a whole conversation with somebody yesterday about, you know, the viewership, the watching component of technology. And I have Alexa all over my, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I have the Amazon product all over my house. And they were like, well, aren't you afraid that people are listening and that they can hear everything you're saying all the time? And I'm like, no, I'm not afraid of it. I assume that's true, but I also know that I don't care. Okay, they could also be listening to me, but I still keep a phone in my pocket every second of every day. So there's still benefit that is outweighed by any of the negatives at this point, at least where we're at now. And yeah, maybe long-term, some of those negatives should be something we worry about. And also even same thing's true in terms of automation and things like that. But in the meantime, we can't just stop using technology. So I think it's a good way to look at it. So absolutely, I think that's great.
Yeah, definitely.
One more thing I wanted to talk to you a little bit about before we get into my normal questions is you are also a podcast host yourself, another show on the Voice Ed Radio Network. And could you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay, so our podcast is called Edunauts, and it actually ties in really nicely with what I'm doing at the moment. And in fact, I met the people that I work with through mutual friends that I'd met through Edunauts, which is kind of handy. So Edunauts is a show that's based around what we call the Future We framework, or future literacies, which is essentially a very bigger, like, that's not good English, a much bigger version of what I'm teaching at the moment. So you can actually find that if anyone's interested. You can have a look at futurewe.org and check it out. But it's basically a framework of all the literacies that people are going to need to survive in the future, and people are going to be looking for, and you know, things that are going to make our lives a whole lot more interesting. So it's really about transferable skills that you can embed into any kind of educational setting, and different ways of thinking and different ways of communicating and collaborating. And, you know, it's all about just being, again, positive about the future and being prepared for it. Because obviously if we can, you know, if we can prepare for not being able to predict the future, then we're not going to be upset when it turns out to be slightly different to what we expected.
Yeah, I like that. I was actually a guest recently on the EduNuts, which took a lot of work and time scheduling and rescheduling, because I'm terrible at keeping my commitments occasionally. And I'm fully owning that I abandoned you, even though I said I was going to be available the first time. That's on me. But yeah, I was recently a guest on there, and it's a cool show. I like the way you guys just kind of free flow chat with a little bit of a guiding topic of one of those future we literacies. And I thought it was a good time. So you can check that out on VoiceEd Radio, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're on VoiceEd Radio. It's generally speaking, it's myself and Jonathan Nolder, who is one of the future we founders. In fact, the future we founder. And of course, Stephen Hurley joins us most of the time, except when he gets stuck in traffic. So it's all pretty good.
Good. Excellent. Well, we're having a good time. It is very early in the morning for me. It's almost your bedtime. I still don't understand how time zones work in this very weird round world, but we're just going to keep moving. And I'm going to ask you my first question, because I'm very curious what your response to this is going to be. As being quite literally from the other side of the world, I am quite interested in your perspective. So tell me, Leanne, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Okay, so the biggest problem that I consider is people's lack of critical abilities. So we've talked about this before. We've talked about fake news and the way that people are getting information. And I think it's not so much a systemic problem in education, although I have met teachers who take their news from Facebook, so that kind of worries me. But my biggest concern is that people are getting, you know, anecdotal evidence and calling it fact, or they're finding, you know, seeing something that's been regurgitated on social media. I read posts on Facebook that are things that I read, you mightn't even remember when you had fax machines and people used to send through like chain letters through faxes. And I see those same chain letter things coming through as Facebook posts, and that really concerns me. And people are sharing them as if they're still fact, you know. So I think one of the biggest threats to education and the biggest problems is that kids are coming into the classroom now with a lack of general knowledge. And so it actually makes it very difficult to start to make connections between different things. It makes it a great challenge for the teachers to be able to say, you know, like to make analogies, for example, and to build on those sort of prior knowledges when they don't exist. So yeah, I think people should talk to their kids more about things and not allow them to, Sorry, I think we just dropped out, but it looks like we might be okay. Yeah, people shouldn't listen to fake news, and people should talk to their parents and kids and have conversations.
So, Leanne, I like that, despite the minor mic drop we just dealt with. No, I like that. That's good. And you did, you're right. We talked on when I was on EduNuts about this, this fake news issue. And it's almost become this joke. Not almost, it has. It's almost funny now, people believing ridiculous things. Before we started recording, we talked about, you know, flat earthers and anti-vaxxers and things like that, where it's like, there's no real evidence to support any of this, but that doesn't seem to matter. You know, and it's this internet thing of there have to be silly people out there that believe things that aren't true. It's weird. It's odd the impact that that has across our society, that we just think it's funny that people believe these, what I would just call crazy things, for lack of a wanting to step on eggshells anymore here. And it does have a huge impact on our classrooms. You know, it becomes so much harder as a teacher when students will just sort of flippantly throw out these insane comments, and it's difficult to tell whether they mean them or they're just a meme that they're throwing back at us. And so I think you're right that it's very difficult when they're lacking. And definitely parents need to talk more to their kids. I can 100% agree with that. Absolutely. The one pushback I think of is like we talked about with technology and job futures as well. I think that there is a consideration to be given to the fact that much of this consequence of these people that believe things that aren't true, or these falsehoods pushing around the world, is because of the democratization of knowledge and publishing that we have right now. And what I mean by that is I can say something on my show that may not be factually accurate, but because of how easy it is to publish something, my show exists. And I believe that on the whole, my show gives a positive to the world, even if on occasion something I say might be sensational or a little exaggerated or taken as fact when I meant it as a joke, that on the whole, I think my show brings a positive. And so if you extend that out to Facebook or you extend that out to social media, I think they bring a positive, and we are just maybe still sort of in the learning curve of how we deal with these things. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that absolutely does. And obviously, the self-publishing and that sort of ability for people to tell their stories digitally much more easily these days is going to come along with, you know, people telling stupid stories. And of course, there always were these people, but they used to be kind of outliers. They used to be the deviants, but now they seem to be the people who shout the loudest. And I think it seems to be a competition to see who can get the most attention. And then that attention seems to give them some sort of credence. So I guess, you know, there's the whole cult of celebrity thing where people believe that if somebody's famous, then they must actually know what they're talking about on something, which is, I mean, I'm sure you have that all the time. You've got your own famous podcast, so people must believe everything that you say.
Only in regards to hair products. But, that's pretty much the only thing people believe me on.
Oh, well, obviously, no. Undisputed expert. But, you know, we do give so much credibility to people just because we know who they are and we know their face. And yet, you know, there's Nobel Prize winning scientists who people will scoff at because they once read a thing on the internet and all they've read since has been something that confirms their bias, and they refuse to believe that there could be such a thing as an actual scientific process.
Yeah. So then the obvious reply to that then is that how do we battle this? How do we go against this? How do we teach students the proper way to consume information critically?
Well, you start by teaching them the scientific process, I guess. You can say, okay, this is your idea. Now you find evidence to back that up, and you teach them how to actually go and locate that evidence and to make decisions about whether it's a reliable source or not. And it doesn't happen overnight, and you have to do it in practically every lesson because it's got to be a continuing thing. There's more and more ways that people can make their things seem credible on the internet, or even, you know, on the local radio station or the television or in politics. You know, people will believe a lot because, you know, somebody important has said it. And we used to have that kind of thing where you could believe the newsreader. You know, you'd always think that the news was objective. You know, what is it, the fourth estate, and they're mm-hmm. keeping everybody honest. And unfortunately, as soon as advertising entered into the news, then that all changed, and, you know, sponsorship became really important. So we need to look at whose agenda things are actually pushing, and then teach our students to always look for that agenda. So even if it's something that's fairly innocuous, like, say, for example, I don't know, publishing a physics textbook, we've actually had a bit of debate, quite considerable debate lately, actually, over the changes in our senior curriculum for science, where they've actually erased pretty much every mention of any women scientists, which is of great concern to me and great concern to most people, because they'll mention by name lots and lots of the men scientists. And let's face it, there were lots and lots of contributions made by men to science, but that shouldn't actually allow them to whitewash other contributions out. So you'd imagine that just publishing a science curriculum is a fairly innocuous and fairly unbiased kind of thing. And yet if you look at it, there's definitely, I don't want to think it's a sinister agenda. I'm sure it was just an oversight by somebody, but you know, there's a bias there, and that's something that we need to examine.
Yeah, and I think I agree. I think that analyzing bias and recognizing the agenda of people, I think that is one of those unbelievably critical skills. But I think that it has become more critical. I think it's something that we probably should have been teaching a long time ago, more than we were. And I would almost make the argument that because we didn't teach this skill necessarily as a necessary process to every kind of consumption, because we weren't teaching that 20 years ago, we have a world full of adults who don't necessarily realize that everything can have an agenda. You know, and I mean, I would be willing to bet, I would think at a safe assumption, that our science textbooks had some form of agenda 20 years ago, but we didn't look at it necessarily with that critical eye. And I think that is maybe the cause of our problems in some ways, is that we weren't teaching this skill from the beginning, and now most people don't think to look at it, so they can't talk to their kids about it. And now it falls on us that have recognized it or are in the classroom to try to have those conversations. So I think that I would make the argument that this is not only the consequence of our democratization of knowledge, but also of our lack of foresight or our lack of recognition of the importance of looking for bias in all sources previously, because we did trust the newsman because it was locked down and we just said if he was there, he was probably telling the truth and not to worry about it.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, the dominant paradigm was very much more dominant and less questioned in those days. And I say in those days, it seems to be not questioned quite enough now either, but still, at least we're having those conversations where difference can be examined and we can actually look at different viewpoints and change perspectives and make sure that we are addressing some silences. But you're right, I didn't come across that stuff in high school. So I started university in 1992, and that was the first time I'd really studied any kind of critical theory. And that absolutely blew my mind. I was like straight to it because that was something that really excited me. And I haven't looked back since. And I know that just being aware of how texts are produced, actually, I think it makes you this is going to sound really cheesy, but I think it does actually make you a better person to, you know, be aware of all of those different perspectives and aware that what you're reading is not just completely black and white.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is cheesy, but I'll allow it. I think it's a fair assumption. I think it is really critical to would call it a healthy skepticism, to be skeptical of things you read in all forms, because there is always a bias. No matter what you do, there's always a bias. So I think you're right. And yeah, I definitely don't remember it being taught other than, like, you know, they would do a lesson, a unit in English on advertising and how advertising was designed to you know, sort of make you think. And I had a really good psychology teacher who talked a little bit about that. But again, it was in these isolated forms where like, look, this is a place where they're very intentionally and very blatantly trying to convince you of something. Let's talk about how they're doing that. And we didn't take that same critical approach to what we would call non, you know, what we would call an informational text or a non, you know, discussion tech. My brain, it's clearly 6:30 in the morning and I can't remember the word. Persuasive. That's the word I'm looking for. Non-persuasive text. We didn't use that same critical lens on a non-persuasive text.
Yeah. And I think we had a different perspective on what a text actually was. And I know that a lot of people still think of a text as just being something that's written, but obviously what we're producing right now is a text, and you know, texts exist in all sorts of different forms, and we need to be able to critically evaluate those, every form. So we need to have those to make sure that those skills that we're teaching to students are not just for the written word, but are for, you know, understanding a whole stack of other things. So I think, I mean, even the clothes that we wear are a text essentially. So, and the things that we're told to wear. So we've had, you know, conversations. We don't have it because we've got school uniforms in most of our schools, but I know that you guys have had lots of conversations about what people should and shouldn't wear to class, and that's producing a text in itself. So we need to broaden our definitions.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Absolutely. Wow, a lot of good stuff already. We're all, you know, we're 20 something minutes in. We're getting some good ideas. I like it. I want to move to my next question. And for, my next question is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Podcasting is great. I really like, I think everybody should be at least having conversations with people across the world. I think it's really exciting. Certainly having conversations online or with people who don't have any of your sort of shared cultural understandings is really great. So, I mean, okay, you're in the States, and that's, we get US culture from television and from the media and so forth, but I'm pretty sure that your understanding of what it means to be American is very different to what my understanding of what it means to be American is. And conversely, I'm pretty sure that, you know, you have a different view of Australia than what's actually out my front door. So, I think all educators should be talking to people in other systems, so that they're not just perpetuating what's going on in their own little bubble.
Okay. I like that. I think that's a fair, fair assumption. And I agree with you that I think way more people should podcast, because podcasting is awesome. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, based on, if I reapply, so you made a comment about your definition of being American versus what I think it is. And, you know, I'm sure there is more to Australia than kangaroos and wallabies and toilets that flush backwards. But that's all I know. And that you live in the future. Those are the four things I know about Australia for the most part. And so I'm sure there is more to being Australian than that. And yeah, you're right. I think that the flip side, the positives of technology, are that it allows us to shrink those barriers. It allows us to shrink those worlds. And, you know, in a simple form, I don't really need to understand time zones because I have a website that I just send you to and it does it for me. And so I think technology gives us the power to make these connections, and it also makes it easier for us to shrink those barriers in a lot of different ways. So I think absolutely it is easy for educators to do. I think most educators would admit that it's probably a good idea to communicate with other educators outside of their sphere, outside of their space, and to bring in new ideas. And yet, I feel, at least here in the US, that the majority of our educators are not connected, are not talking to people outside their sphere and their bubble. And I can't speak for Australia, but definitely for us, I don't think the majority are. So why is that? Why are they not doing this thing that is simple, not a super time-consuming activity, and we can all agree is probably beneficial? Why is that not happening more often?
I worry that a lot of teachers, I don't want to say a lot of teachers, I don't want to make generalizations, but I know that there are teachers out there who genuinely think of their teaching life as something discrete. Instead of looking around and bringing all of the other things in their life into their classroom. They just sort of lock up the classroom, go home, have a different life. And that, I worry that people are turning themselves into teachers and forgetting that they're people. So, you know, I think that we need to really just back up a bit and remember that we're not servicing the government's agendas. We're not, we're not really, regardless of what the school boards or whatever tell us, we're not just here to get good test scores. We're teaching human beings, and the best way to do that is to actually be a fairly rounded human being yourself and to model that kind of behavior that you want your students to be modeling. So if you want your students to be globally aware, and if you want your students to be empathetic and to have different perspectives, and you don't yourself, then they're going to see straight through you. They're going to know that you're not authentic and that you don't take an interest in the real world, and you're not really interested in what goes on in their life, and you know, you're just kind of going through the motions. And that really does concern me, because we've got to be full people, you know, rounded people.
That's interesting, that idea of their that isolation of your job, that closing of the door. But in a lot of fields, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. You don't need to bring all of yourself into most fields of work. And yet, I think you're right. For educators, it's absolutely critical. I like that. The image of sort of locking the door and leaving your teacher self at home, at school, and then going home, is true. And yet, there are certainly days that I have done the same. You know, sometimes the teaching life leaking out, if you will, into your real life can be a huge stress. So I understand why teachers do it. And bringing yourself into your classroom, often, depending on your administration, is frowned upon because they don't want your personal opinions in the classroom. So I understand why teachers do that too. And yet I don't see that as where we need to be taking education. Again, going all the way back, that's the kind of stuff. If those are the things you're not doing, you're only doing the parts of your job that can be automated.
And we should be teaching kids to have difficult conversations. I mean, where else are they going to learn them? If their parents aren't talking to them, but, you know, people do have conversations with their parents, obviously, but, a parent is generally not trying to upset the child or trying to disagree with them. So, where else do you get those conversations if not in school? And where else do you learn those skills to be able to hold an argument without losing your temper and without it turning into, you know, the end of the world if you find that somebody has a different opinion to you?
Yeah, I agree. I think I can agree with you. I think way more of us need to be connecting outside of our sphere. Way more of us need to be bringing more of ourselves into our classrooms. I am 100% on board. I'm with you completely. Good stuff. I'm feeling good. This is a great way to start my day. I should do way more interviews at 6:30 in the morning. I'm like ready and pumped and go for my day. But before I do that, one last question for you. And my last question for all my guests is always, who is the greatest teacher you have ever had?
Oh, okay. I really hated school. I have to tell you, I absolutely hated school. I was really good at it. And that's part of the reason I hated it, because if you're good at school, particularly in Australia, there's a bit of an anti, or it's changing, but there was certainly a bit of anti-intellectualism when I was at school. So, and I was a bit of a smart aleck kid, and I was sort of forever correcting my teacher's spelling on the blackboard and that kind of thing. You know, back in the days where we actually had blackboards. But, my year 12, 11 and 12 physics teacher, a guy called Mr. Buck Bardas. He was a terrible teacher, like absolutely dreadful. He was a guy who became a teacher because he was an engineer and then hated engineering, so he thought he'd go into teaching, right? But as a terrible teacher, he actually did a really good job of making me love physics, because we'd have lessons where we'd be discussing things like Doctor Who and how improbable and why the physics in Doctor Who was improbable and, you know, why you can't just throw a tennis ball in space and all of that really cool stuff. So he actually made me think really laterally about things and I really loved it. And we would have conversations about science fiction and all sorts of crazy stuff. And so, and then the year after I graduated, Isaac Asimov died, which absolutely devastated me. And I've never, you know, I don't do the whole fangirly thing or anything like that. I don't get really involved in celebrities, but Isaac Asimov, dude, it was just pretty important. So, and I knew that he'd be in the staff room. So I went back to my old school and I went to the staff room and I just sort of looked at him and he's like, I know. And we sat down and we both had a little bit of a cry together and it was really lovely. So, you know, some people impact you not because they're really, really good at teaching your curriculum, but because they make connections.
It's a, I don't know, oddly beautiful moment as the greatest teacher you've ever had, you blatantly admit was not a good teacher. But that is, I like that. I think what you point to there is the recurring theme of the answers to that question, which is it's never the content that makes your greatest teacher. It's never because you remembered phenomenal, you know, I will never forget pi because of this amazing teacher. Like that's not what it is. It's the people they are. And again, going back to what you think they need to do, part of that connection is bringing their real selves into the classroom and bringing your real self as a teacher into the classroom. I feel like brings in the real student, that brings in the full student into the classroom. And I think that's exactly what your story illustrates, is that it isn't the content. It isn't the teaching. It's the human. It's the human that makes the difference for us.
Yeah. And you know what? That's a learned skill. And I wish that people, part of it is kind of, you're born to be a teacher, I suppose. And there's this real myth that teachers are some kind of superheroes, that, you know, you go into teaching because you love the kids and you just want to do the best for them. And, you know, some people do, and that's part of it, obviously. But teaching is a profession. It's something that you learn, that you constantly update and you constantly try new things and you fail and you give it another shot. It's a profession like any other, and yet we always sort of belittle it by saying, oh, you know, teachers are magical and they're, you know, fantastic, like we're some kind of unicorn or something, which is just really disturbing because you don't talk about nurses having a superpower because they've got, you know, the ability to hold their bladder for hours and hours. But, you know, we just have this ridiculous perception that somehow teachers aren't as professional as lawyers or doctors or anything like that. And that absolutely needs to change because what we do is, it's vital, it's really important, and we need to make sure that we're doing it as best we can.
Yeah, I agree. I see what you mean about the sort of like teachers are magical belief system, right? And it's funny because when I look at my educational history, when I look at that first year teaching, I thought I was doing so well. I thought I was doing it. And yet I look back now and I was doing everything wrong. And like you said, it's a learned skill. You don't just imagine or wake up one day and just know how to teach. And you don't just go into the classroom and know how to teach. It takes trial and error and it takes failures left and right in order to be able to understand it. So, I agree. I think you nailed it. I think you got it dead on. Leanne, I don't want to waste your time. I want to let you get to bed. I got to get ready for work. The world is a strange place. I so appreciate what you talking to me today, having this conversation with me about education and all these great topics we've talked about. For my audience, if they'd like to reach out to you, how can they get a hold of you best?
Okay, so if you want to get hold of me, I'm on Twitter. I have really creative handles. I am @LeanneHanson. I also have my own website if anyone happens to be interested in reading lots and lots of poems that I'm never going to publish. I live at leannehansen.com.au. So I'm pretty easy to find all over social media.
I am another one with a very inability to come up with unique titles, as I'm at Brad Treffler, so I'm not judging. And Leanne, thank you again so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time and dealing with the kangaroos and wallabies or whatever that have been chewing on your internet cables, because the internet in Australia is weird. And yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Leanne, thank you so much for chatting with me. I appreciate you making me wake up early so I could keep you up past your bedtime. To connect with Leanne, check her out on Twitter. She's at Leanne Hansen. You can also look at her website and read some of her poetry at leannehansen.com.au. Links to both of those are, of course, in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Treffler. I love to hear from you guys there, especially if you'd like to be a guest on the show. I'm always looking for future guests, so if you think you have something to say, reach out. Or on the feedback page on my website, which gives you additional options for feedback, which is at bradtreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, be skeptical of all kinds of text. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.
I think the kangaroos have been chewing on the wires again.